Hey, I'm Brett Podolsky, co-founder of The Farmer's Dog. We make fresh food for dogs. We started the company when we saw what a huge difference it made in my own dog, Jada, when she stopped eating ultra-processed kibble and started eating fresh, whole food. The Farmer's Dog food isn't fancy. It's just real food delivered to your door in pre-portioned packs. It's better for them and easier for you.
Get 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/podcast. That's thefarmersdog.com/podcast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And I don't know about you guys, but in this day and age, the way that the world is going crazy, I think we could all use a Duff McKagan joke of the week right now.
Hey, Chris Jericho, it's Duff McKagan calling you. I'm taking my dog for a walk right now. She's doing a number two as we speak. It's glorious. Anyhow, do you know the difference between a well-dressed man on a unicycle and a poorly dressed man on a bicycle? Attire. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
All right, that was a good one. Duff has redeemed himself. Legit laugh out loud for that one. And check out Duff multitasking at home, walking the dog and calling in jokes. And while rehearsing for hopefully the Mexico tour of Guns N' Roses, coronavirus hasn't stopped them yet. They're headed back to the States as well for the summer 2020 stadium tour starting July 4th in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You can get tickets at GunsN'Roses.com. What's up with these tour names? The summer 2020 stadium tour for Guns N' Roses, the stadium tour for Motley Crue and Def Leppard, the big rock summer tour for Skid Row and Rat. Like, come on, guys. You should be doing something. Call yourself, like, Save the World Tour, which we're still doing April 16th, starting in Savannah, Georgia. Hopefully the coronavirus won't derail that. It's going to be one of our biggest tours we've ever had. Keep buying your tickets now because it looks like we're going to be close to 90% sold out before we even start the tour. So hopefully you guys will be there. Even though Pearl Jam just canceled the tour in Coachella, Stagecoach Festivals postponed in October, but Fozzy Rock's on for now. So get your tickets at FozzyRock.com. Like I said, Save the World Tour starting April 16th in Savannah, Georgia, 17th at 98 Rock Fest in Tampa, 18th at WJRR's Earth Day Birthday. Then we're in Chattanooga, Johnson City, which is sold out, Charlotte, Nashville, Louisville, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Buffalo, Iowa City, Iowa, Twin City Takeover at the Target Center in Minneapolis on May 8th, May 9th at the Royal Grove in Lincoln, Nebraska. So many more dates as well. Just go to FozzyRock.com and check out all, I think there's 30 or 40 dates for the Save the World Tour, including the Kiss Cruise, October 30th. We set sail. So we're going to be on that one. FozzyRock.com for all gig information. And don't forget FozzyRock.com for VIP meet and greets. Come hang out with us before the show. We do a private mini concert for you. We sign your stuff. We hang out. We meet you. We greet you. We treat you like the king and queen that you are. And we've already sold out of the VIP in Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Lancaster, and Buffalo. Looks like Cleveland and I believe Louisville will be next. So don't be scared. Sign up now. We don't want to miss you. So now that all that's been taken care of, today Excalibur makes his Talk as Jericho debut, part of the AEW announced team, working alongside good old Jim Ross and Tony Schiavone on Dynamite. What you might not know is that Excalibur is one of the founding fathers of PWG, Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, which used to be based in Los Angeles, one of the hottest indie promotions in the world, attracting all kinds of celebrity fans, became the place to wrestle on the indie scene to this day. Also gave a bunch of superstar talents their starts. We're going to talk about all that stuff with the masked, mysterious Excalibur coming up now on Talk is Jericho. Okay, backstage here in Atlanta with the mysterious and verbose Excalibur. It's interesting because I never really know exactly what your day is like here at an AW Dynamite taping. And you said in about an hour's time or so, you have to go do a sound check. Explain what exactly you have, what that means.
So we get with the myself, JR, Tony Schiavone, we get on the headsets and we basically do a dry run through our onstage or, you know, our on-cam segment during the show. So when we're running down the card, that sort of stuff. And then Justin Roberts will do a mock ring introduction with lights, music, and everything. And so it's basically just a rehearsal and just making sure all the levels are right. And they're, you know, they're transmitting it usually to Atlanta, even though we're in Atlanta today, but they usually transmit it to CNN, make sure everything's right on their end. And then, you know, then we just go from there. They keep those levels locked in for the rest of the show.
So how has that been for you? I mean, obviously I know you had done some commentating for a while. There's lots to talk about, but this is kind of getting thrown into the deep end, national television, right off the bat, in front of millions of people, with obviously, you know, with Jim Ross and Tony Schiavone, two of the greatest of all time. What was your mindset in getting the gig, taking the gig, and how you would fit in such a giant world that we live in?
I was pleasantly surprised. It was all out was actually when I first found out that, I'm sorry, All in 2018.
I get them mixed up too.
But that's when Matt and Nick, the Bucks, reached out to me and they said, hey, we want you to be a part of that show. And
That was with Don Callis and Ian Riccaboni,
myself, and we had a couple of guests. But anyway, and so that was my first experience doing like a pay-per-view or any type of show like that, because before that it was just PWG indie shows and that sort of stuff. And after that was over, I thought, like, oh, that was just a one and done. What a great experience. Really happy to be there. Little did I know that that was essentially our pilot episode, for lack of a better term, for Turner.
Which it really was.
Yeah.
For Tony Khan as well, and for everybody involved.
Yeah. I mean, if not a pilot episode, a proof of concept.
Sure.
At the very least. And so, yeah, then Matt and Nick, after it was over, they were like, you know, don't go anywhere because there's something else coming over the horizon. I was like, yeah, you know, it's wrestling. I'll believe it when I see
right,
it.
Exactly.
And then, you know, I saw the announcement for AEW on January 1st of 2019. And I was like, oh, this is what they were talking about. I sure hope that there's a spot for me. I didn't want to get my hopes up. And then they asked me to do the press conference in Vegas for the ticket on sale announcement and that sort of stuff. I'm like, oh, this might actually happen. And then they told me, hey, we want you to fly to Atlanta and do a rehearsal with Jim Ross. And I was like, okay, I guess.
Meaning kind of like a chemistry test?
Yes,
maybe?
Exactly. Like a dry run. Right. Yeah, screen test, for lack of a better
term. Sure, of course.
Yeah. And so we did it. And JR, when he first saw me, he's like, why do you wear a mask? I'm like, because I always did. That was my wrestling character. He's like, well, yeah, but why are you doing it now? Nobody can see you. And I'm like, it's just what everybody knows me by. And he was really worried that I was out to get myself over at the expense of everybody else. But I think after one day of us working together, he kind of realized that I put everybody else over at my own expense. Mm-hmm. Like I am constantly trying to put everything over as to the best of my abilities.
It's interesting to me because, once again, I've said this a few times, when I first signed with AEW, there was not a number of guys, but coming from my world, which is, you know, big time WrestleMania, WWF, and the Vince McMahon way of thinking, forgetting what the basics of wrestling is, which is if you want to make it and do something different.
Mm-hmm.
So when I first see Marco's stunt, I was like, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've told Marco this, and then now he's one of the most over guys in the show. Orange Cassidy, same thing. Why the hell are we signing this guy? It's blasphemy.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with why. I said the same. Why does the guy wear a mask as an announcer?
Mm-hmm.
It's stupid, right? And then now you've become the guy with the mask.
Yeah.
It makes you stand out from other.
Yeah, if you're flipping through the channels and you happen to see a guy in a cowboy hat, a guy with a diamond earring, and a guy in a mask, you're gonna at least stop for a half a second and say, "What is this?"
Why do you wear a mask?
It's because that's what I, you know, when I had a wrestling career.
So you started as a wrestler.
Yes.
Because I think a lot of people might not know that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you might have mentioned it in passing here and there, but I think a lot of people are still kind of like, why does this guy wear a mask?
Yeah.
So you started as a wrestler.
I started as a wrestler in 1999, Southern California, and, you know, started training. I grew up in Detroit, moved out to LA to follow my dream of being a wrestler. moved out there, and you know, because LA has, you know, so close to Mexico, really steeped in the Lucha Libre traditions, and I was a big fan of the New Japan Junior style from the 90s, and specifically Michinoku Pro.
Were you a tape trader?
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. As, I've in my dad's basement, I have stacks and stacks of
It's so
of
funny VHS how that tapes. Used to be, you know, to see something you would have to trade with friends.
Yeah.
Now all of those tapes are just on YouTube.
It's different now. Yeah. It's wild. There was the pride and joy of my collection is I got like a pristine copy of the Michinoku These Days show. It was like the 10/10/96 show, but it was like a first generation, like recorded right off the master. And I was like, oh my God, this is the Holy Grail. But anyway, so I digress. I really loved those guys, yourself included. Like that junior heavyweight style in the 90s is really, I mean, that's like the sweet spot of wrestling to me.
Well, it was pioneering, but there was a lot more diversity I found. You kind of have a little bit of that now, but there was a real distinct weight class. Like now in New Japan, like Will Ospreay just announced he's going to be heavyweight. Mm-hmm. And Naito is heavyweight champion, but he's probably weighs 180 pounds. Like there's a real division between, I don't remember to phrase that, a real delusion between the two. Whereas before, junior heavyweight was junior heavyweight. That's the way it was. But there are so many talented guys in this kind of new division from all different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you think about it, like Zack Sabre Jr. has been heavyweight in New Japan since day one.
And guy weighs 150.
Yeah.
He's incredible. But let's be honest, right?
Yeah. If they're really sticking to this 100 kilo thing, then why is Zach in there and why is not Will?
Well, and that's the thing too. Like Otani, for example, was a career junior heavyweight in New Japan. Mm-hmm. He's twice the size of Zack Sabre. You know, a big kid. Takaiwa the same. These are tall, big guys, but they're all legit 220 and under, 100 kilos. Problem is nowadays, there's not a lot of guys that even weigh 100 kilos, right?
Yeah. And it's, and like Shingo Takagi is, you know, he was a natural heavyweight. And then, you know, but when he came to New Japan, he had to go into the junior heavyweight division to...
Why was that?
I don't know. Right. I mean, you know, I mean...
who knows?
Yeah, right. they have their reasons.
Point but, being, back in the 90s, yes, there was one or the other.
A very clear delineation between the weight size, or, you know, the weight classes. And for myself and all of my, you know, friends that I started training with, the junior heavyweight style is the style that we loved. And because... I mean, you also have to think on, you know, American wrestling at that time, the stuff that was most readily available in the mid-90s was just, you know, like, I mean, no offense, but big plotting guys doing big plotting moves. It wasn't the most, you know, it wasn't the most exciting style. Where then you have these guys that are incorporating, you know, a more hard-hitting style, you know, more hard-hitting Japanese style with a high-flying Lucha Libre style. That was like mind-blowing, and that was so
exciting. And the business has changed, right? Because, like, if you think about, let's say, you know, Okada and Tanahashi, like, kind of still almost junior heavyweights. Okada's taller, but I mean, but their style has a lot of
Ibushi.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean,
so, but in the 90s, when you had junior heavyweights, heavyweights were basically punching, kicking, chopping. I think of Tenryu as kind of the prototype of that era.
Yeah.
Powerbomb. Maybe to really pop the crowd, he might fly across the floor or something.
But. Well, and then the All Japan, you know, like the four pillars, those guys were also, I mean, you know, if that junior heavyweight style is my favorite, if that's number one, 1A is that that King's Road style. Then
Kawada,
Tawei, Kobashi, and Misawa.
Yeah.
And then, and even before that, Jumbo Tsuruta. Mm-hmm. When the match where Misawa pinned Jumbo Tsuruta for the first time, I don't think I've ever heard a pop like that. And it was insane. But that was, you know, the passing of the torch that, like...
And once again, dealing with a guy who started out as a Tiger Mask.
As a junior heavyweight.
But then literally went and gained 20, 30 pounds.
If not more,
Yeah, it wasn't just one day he's a heavyweight, one day he's a junior heavyweight. He went away and did his, you know, did his time outside. But, you know, anyways, we've kind of got off topic. But still, it was a brilliant time for Japanese wrestling in the 90s, and that very much influenced you for what you were doing when you started.
Yes. And so we, you know, going to Los Angeles, there was kind of two options. You either trained in, you know, like the American style with UPW, which was a, you know, WWE or WWF developmental territory at that time, and then, or you could, you know, train in Lucha Libre. And so, you know, I went to what was effectively a Lucha school, but it was called Revolution Pro, not associated with the Rev Pro UK, but it was the original Revolution Pro. But, and it was kind of strictly a lucha style, but there was a group of like-minded individuals there. Myself, Super Dragon, this guy Rising Sun, Disco Machine, Mr. Excitement. We all loved the hybrid style.
Are these guys with their names, are any of them working today?
Not anymore, no.
Gotcha.
Myself and Super Dragon are kind of like the last vestiges of it in pro wrestling, but Dragon, he just, you know, books and promotes PWG. And
oh, gotcha. So he's kind of in that world now.
Yeah,
there was used to be a Lucha Libre shows that I did in L.A. When
Martin Marin,
Marin
at the Anaheim Marketplace.
Was it Superboy was in there? One of the guys. Superboy was one of the ones. Yeah,
yeah.
That's funny. Yeah, there's always been a thriving scene in L.A. Dating back to the '60s and '70s with LaBelle and you know Olympic Auditorium and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, and so we were training there, and then actually somebody that you might know, Blitzkrieg. Also trained there, and that's kind of the school that he came out of, and that was like those were his contemporaries. And so I got there right after Blitzkrieg got signed to WCW, and I started training
there. Gosh, he won like Rookie of the Year, and then next year just disappeared.
Because, well, you know what it was, his heart, he didn't love wrestling. Everybody else that was at RevPro, they all loved wrestling. He was just an athletic freak, and they're like, oh, you have to wrestle, you have to wrestle. And he's like, eh, my heart's not really into it. But
what does he do now? Anywhere?
I have no idea.
Gotcha.
He was at one point was making videos for raves, like fractal videos for raves.
Yeah, you see those guys come and go, you know what I mean? That's why when someone has longevity, it's hard to survive in this business, as you would know.
And especially if you're not passionate about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that happens in all sports where it's like somebody might be genetically gifted, but if their heart's not into it, they wash out after a couple
years. Yeah, you're right. You can see that. You can see that.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/RS10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/RS10 today.
So when you started working, were you in the mask right away?
Yeah, from day one, I was in the mask. I wore a different mask when I was doing backyard wrestling, and then Excalibur, the switching to that mask and that character was like my graduation from like backyard to.
Who was your backyard character?
El Scorpio Diablo.
The Devil Scorpio.
So I switched to Excalibur, and you know, from there on out, I was just living in Super Dragon's garage in Garden Grove, California, with no air conditioning and with no, like, I had $2,000 to my name, and then that slowly dwindled because I wasn't making any money wrestling, surprisingly. And we just tried to wrestle as much as possible, whether it was on, you know, student shows at the RevPro Dojo, which was a garage that you could fit maybe 30 people in, or just, you know, trying to get booked around Southern California. But the thing was, we were kind of the black sheep, because UPW, which, you know, was the WWF developmental territory, those
Cena came from there.
Cena, Samoa Joe, spent the very early days of his career there. But that was very much, you know, seven steps of psychology. This is what you do. Always work to the hard cam. It's like, we're on an indie show. There's no hard cams here. But we just kind of wanted to go out and have exciting matches where they were just doing, you know, punch, kick, body slam. You know, that sort
the
of
WWF, stuff.
Exactly
WWE
the
style,
prototype,
yeah.
And so eventually, a lot of the undercard UPW guys started coming to our shows, the RevPro shows, because then they got a chance to cut loose. And that style that we were working in '99 and 2000 is I would say kind of, you know, it's an impression of the Japanese junior heavyweight style, but then also like the current American indie style, or the, I mean, even the current American style, mm-hmm. because, you know, is all kind of has roots.
It all becomes a hybrid, doesn't yeah. it? You know, I know that even like from when I grew up watching Stampede Wrestling, mm-hmm. I didn't know at the time why I loved it more than WWF, but it's because it was a combination. If you look at a guy like Owen Hart, for example, they would bring in the top Mexican guys, the top Japanese mm-hmm. guys, the top Europeans. And so Stampede was basically a hybrid of all those styles.
Yep.
And if you could make it in Calgary, you would come out of that. Even the schooling that I got, you would come out of there knowing how to do things that most kids at a wrestling school wouldn't, just because of the way that the territory was stylistically.
Yeah, and it gives you an opportunity to be successful anywhere in the world.
Right.
Rather than only working one style. I mean, you have... You know, so many lucha guys that come to the States and they have trouble adapting
right.
to this style. Or, you know, like when New Japan runs those Fantastica Mania shows, they're essentially lucha shows. You know, they're kind of doing lucha style matches, a little more logical, you know, to the Japanese audience, but still essentially lucha matches. And, you know, that's kind of something that not a lot of guys get credit for. If they can adapt to, you know, European style, a British style, an American indie style, an American big arena style, a Mexican big arena style, you know, like yeah, being able to adapt is like, that is so valuable. And I think that's something that not a lot guys didn't used to be able to do that, but I think more and more people recognize, I mean, in order to have any sort of longevity in this business, you need to adapt and you right, need sure. to.
Sure. And the styles to change too. And speaking of that, how did you transition from wrestling in a mask to commentating in a mask?
Well, so when we started PWG...
Okay, let's just start with that. Okay. Let's just go into that.
Then. Yeah.
Because I had no idea. I kind of did, but, you know, like the business moves fast.
Yeah.
Didn't realize that you were one of the originators of PWG, mm-hmm. which is, to this day, still one of the hippest, hottest indie federations in the States, in the world.
Yeah.
It's kind of become a modern-day ECW, where if you can go to PWG, you know, you can make it anywhere if you can make it there.
Fans have said it's akin to CBGB, you know, where it's like if you have a good showing there, then, you know, you're all of a sudden your name value, you know, skyrockets, and then you become in demand and that sort of stuff. But that was not what we set out for. You know, we had very humble origins. It sure. was just six guys that pulled together a couple $1,000 and decided to run a wrestling show because, you know, I mean, being on the indies, we had tons of bad experiences where it's like, you know, you get promised, you know, gas money, but then at the end of the night you just get maybe a sandwich if you're lucky.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. There was one guy that ran a 9/11 benefit show and then left at intermission with all the money, and so all the guys had to...
It's just amazing how low some of the promoters can be, right?
And I think wrestling has changed for the better mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. Like those kind of carny guys are a dying breed in wrestling.
Well, I think too, with the internet and cell phones and all that stuff, the word gets around so fast, the world has shrunk so much
yeah.
that you can't get away with that shit.
You get away with it once. Yeah.
And then even so, you'll get, you know, 500 people tweeting you and Instagramming you and burying mm-hmm. you. It might, you know, make you think twice about ever doing it again.
Yeah. And so we just got sick of doing that and, you know, going out there and having, you know, like great matches for other people and just kind of wanted to, great in quotes.
But great to you at the time.
Yeah, at the time. And, you know, busting our ass, I'll say. For other people, we said, why not do it
entertaining
ourselves?
Entertaining people.
Yeah. And so we just decided, hey, we can do it. And so there was a venue just outside of LA that they had their own ring. So like basically it was like a turnkey thing where you could just come in, post up your banner, and then like that was your building
for sure,
that
yeah.
night. Yeah. And so, you know, the startup costs in that regard were pretty low. And so six of us pooled our money together, myself, Super Dragon, Disco Machine, Top Gun Talwar, Scott Lost, and Joey Ryan.
And, oh, I didn't know Joey was one of the originals.
Joey is one of the co-founders. And so we did that. That was in July of 2003. And it just kind of took on a life of its own after that, you know.
How did it take on a life of its own, though?
Because this was just after Ring of Honor started. Mm-hmm. And Ring of Honor kind of got their idea from the King of Indies tournament that APW did in, I think it was 2000.
Was APW like in Delaware?
NorCal.
Gotcha.
San Francisco. So
they would kind of have like almost the best of the Super Juniors type tournament.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. They did kind of like an Indie J Cup, for lack of a better term. And, you know, they had Brian Danielson, Samoa Joe, Christopher Daniels, Donovan Morgan, and Super Dragon was also on that show. And he saw that and he's like, that was really cool. We should do that, but as like an ongoing thing. And so the main event of the first PWG show was actually supposed to be Samoa Joe versus AJ Styles, but Joe, I think he broke his elbow or something like that. And so Frankie Kazarian, SoCal guy, mm-hmm. he stepped up and he wrestled AJ in the main event of the first PWG show. And then after that, there was a lot of good feedback, a lot of good word of mouth. And so we just started mixing these shows with a lot of local SoCal guys, up and coming guys, and you know, like big indie names.
A fly-in.
Yeah, fly-in.
So for that first one, you flew in AJ Styles.
Yeah.
And you pulled in your money. I'm sure that's where most of the budget went.
That was, I say 90% of the budget went to that. But yeah, and so I mean that's how it all started. And actually, somebody that you might know was also on that first show, Scorpio Sky.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And so let's say when you brought in AJ, and what was that? 17,
almost, so 16 and a half, yeah.
What did you pay AJ to do the show?
Oh, I can't remember, but it was, if it was $1,000, we were probably sweating that. Gotcha. We were going to sell, you know, because tickets were probably like 15, 20 bucks.
And so how do you draw a crowd for that too? That's pre-internet era.
It was pre-internet, but what we would just go around flyer at other shows. And actually, no, it wasn't pre-internet because there was a website called SoCal Uncensored, which is where SCU takes their name from. And they kind of like aggregated and promoted all the local events in and around Southern California. And so, you know, we were still getting booked on other shows. So we would go and take a stack of flyers to these shows that we would work on. And then Steve Bryant from SCU, he would come to the RevPro Dojo shows back in, when we were in a warehouse in Anaheim. And so we knew him. And he did an interview with the six of us right before the first show. And it was like, looking back on it now, it's just so cringeworthy. Like, you know, the things that you thought were funny 20 years ago, it's just like, it's like, oh, I can't believe it. But, you know, and so we did an interview and it generated a lot of buzz. And so that, I mean, so it was, you know, it was kind of going viral before going viral was a thing, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's like, wow, these guys are crazy enough to run a show, to bring in AJ Styles, to do, you know, to do all this stuff. Like, and so, you know, then the next show after that, We went to a different building, different ring. We brought in like Adam Pearce and, you know, guys that were a little more experienced, that were local guys, but that they'd been around to kind of help us get our footing. And then, you know, started bringing in, you know, Joe then wrestled on the next show. And then after that, we did the whole goal was to do our own Indie J Cup. And I think our third show was our title, you know, our title match tournament, which was our very first Indie J Cup. You know, show.
So would you do, was the idea to do once a month or once a week? Okay.
Yeah, it was once a month. And then a couple of years in, we got a little too big for our britches and started running twice a month. Mm-hmm. And it was just, you know, because we all had our day jobs and stuff like that while we were doing this. And we just got burnt out too quickly. But we were doing once a month for, I mean, probably 10 years straight. And that included, like, we took a detour in Europe in 2004. We did shows with WXW in Germany, and we did shows in the UK. And so we kind of grew. We were kind of under the radar. Like, Ring of Honor was taking all the attention. We were kind of growing under the radar. But, you know, through that early tape trading or that early 2000s tape trading, that's right when, you know, the internet and forums and stuff were coming up. We were getting a lot of buzz through there. And because we had these shows that we needed to sell videotapes in order to make our money back,
right.
I started doing commentary just out of necessity. Mm. And again, at first, those very, very first shows were terrible. The commentary was terrible. Like, I couldn't even listen to it today. Mm-hmm. But it was something that, you know, as the product evolved and as I realized that there was more eyes on it and more, the in-ring action was getting better and better and better, that I, you know, by, you know, telling jokes or being shticky or whatever, I was doing the in-ring stuff a disservice. And so I started to take it a little more seriously. And I never had any aspirations beyond doing PWG. And so, you know, I just thought, like, hey, if this in-ring action, if we're going to have literally the best wrestling in the world inside our ring, my commentary needs to, at the very least, not take away from it.
Exemplify that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Add to it.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter your search based on the qualities that are most important to you. Then you can book a free 15-minute consultation call with any therapist you're interested in seeing, so you can get a feel for whether they're the right fit before you commit to a full-length session. Alma also makes it easy for mental health care providers to navigate insurance. That's why 95% of therapists in their directory accept insurance for sessions, so you can find care that's affordable without stressing about the paperwork. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy60 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy60.
When did you find that PWG made the jump to what it is today?
It was the 2006 Battle of Los Angeles, which is Battle of Los Angeles, an annual tournament.
Great name. Rage Against the Machine. Yes. Album.
And it, you know, again, that super indie, or that J Cup style tournament, where it's a multi-person elimination tournament over, sometimes it would be over the course of one night, but it would be typically 2 or 3 days. And for the second tournament, we flew in a bunch of guys from Dragon Gate, and Shima, who's here tonight, Masato Yoshino, a bunch of those guys came over, and they saw what the American guys or the Canadian guys on our show were doing, and they were like, "Holy shit, there's some like talented guys here." So they started bringing those guys over for tours, and after that, I think PWG within the wrestling community became a place for guys to get noticed. You know, if like, oh, you know, they just brought over El Generico and Kevin Steen on a month-long Dragon Gate tour. Mm-hmm. If I can get booked on that show and I can get noticed by Shima, then I can, you know, get booked in Japan, sure, you know, and like that sort of thing. And so that was like the very early seeds of it. But I think in about 2008, 2009, we had like an insane roster of guys. We had Brian Danielson, Chris Hero, Steen and Generico.
Owens and Zane.
Yeah, Owens and Zane. You know, we had Claudio Castagnoli, Cesaro,
right.
Roderick Strong, Austin Aries, Matt Sydal, Alex Shelley, Chris Sabin, like all these guys all on the same show.
Amazing.
Together. And then I think it became like, even if Dragon Gate's not going to be there, if you get booked on PWG, then you've kind of made it.
Once again, it was like if you could get into ECW in 95 or 96, you would get major coverage in all the magazines and get a real buzz and all that sort of thing. And that's what PWG became, because you also refused to go to a bigger building.
Mm-hmm.
What was the building you used to run in?
It was the Reseda American Legion Hall.
And what was the capacity?
500 if we really, you know, asses to elbows.
Yeah. So how, why did you refuse to ever move to a bigger place?
That was all Super Dragon. Over time, of the founding guys, four of the six of us all kind of, you know, they got retired from wrestling, got real jobs, just kind of, you know, peeled off and did other things. And so at the end of the day, it was myself and Super Dragon that were kind of left. And Dragon has always had this mentality of, you know, I want to keep it special. I want to keep it
exclusive.
Yeah. But you know, for the people that really love it, you know, it's like, you know, he's traveled around. He loves, you know, Guns N' Roses and the White Stripes. Those are his two bands. And,
right.
And he's traveled around the world to see them in, you know, like the smallest clubs on like pop-up shows and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so he loves that vibe, loves that atmosphere, and wanted to, you know, kind of keep that magic. And that's, you know, why, you know, for better or worse, the business model has not changed in, you know, 10 years.
You had to move to a new building.
Yeah, because the American Legion Post, number 308, Reseda, California, they sold the building. It's becoming like an assisted living home or something like that. But it's, you know, it's a very large lot of land in Los Angeles, which I'm sure is very valuable. Mm-hmm. And so whatever they were making off of our shows was not enough to keep the doors open. But
so how did it become kind of the place to be from a celebrity standpoint? Because there's a lot of celebs that went to
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it was, you know, friends of friends would, there's Chris Hero, who was a huge part of PWG. He was friends with this guy, Jensen Karp. Jensen Karp, who now hosts Kevin and Bean, what used to be Kevin and Bean in LA.
Right.
He's now the co-host of of that show in the morning. Yeah. And he ran a gallery in LA, and he'd been around entertainment and music for a while, and so he started coming to the shows. He was a wrestling fan, and he started coming to the shows, and then he started telling people about it. Then other people would tell their friends. Joey Ryan somehow got to be friends with Chris Bauer, who was an actor who was on. He met Chris while he was on True Blood, but Chris was on. I mean, he'll always be in my heart as Frank Sabatka from The Wire season two, and so he started coming. And then when True Blood did their rap party, Chris's gift to the cast was that he bought out a section at PWG, and so that's when Joe Manganiello came, and he brought Sofia Vergara, and and that sort of stuff. And then Ronda Rousey, who was, before she got involved in pro wrestling, when she was just doing MMA, she was still a huge pro wrestling fan. Yeah. And so Shayna Baszler and Jessamyn Duke and Marina Shafir would come, and they're like, oh, we got to bring Ronda. And then Ronda came, and people lost their shit. But the cool thing was is that our fans, for the most part, were really respectful of her time and just letting her enjoy the show just like they wanted to do. And, at intermission or after the show, people would come up for autographs. But, there was such a great vibe, and I think that was all part and parcel of keeping it small and keeping condensed, that everybody that was coming to the shows felt like family, and they knew that, Billy Corgan would come, and they were like, oh, we're not going to bother him during the show, right. And
there's nowhere to hide. There's no VIP section.
Right, yeah. It's just this, it's a square room with, no corners. The only place to hide is the bathroom, and there's, yeah.
And Dave Meltzer would show up.
My biggest thing was Mike Patton from Faith No More showed up, and I am... my number one, and I wanted to be respectful of him and not want to bother him or anything, but I'm like, when am I ever gonna get a chance to talk to him? So I just went up and I had to be like, hey, I just want to let you know that your music is so important to me, and it's really cool that you're here at this thing that I did. Thank you. And I just ran away.
Sure. Give him the respect.
Yeah,
it's funny because I was in Jay and Silent Bob Reboot, mm-hmm. and Joe was in that.
Yeah.
And I went to the premiere in LA, and Sophia was there, and she hardly looked up from her phone once, but we had a conversation because I knew he was a fan through PWG. But like you said, when you become a wrestling fan, it's universal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the fact Patton was there, he's not going to tell you to fuck off when you go say hi to him, because it's part of the community atmosphere.
Yeah. And so that was really cool. So it's like, I guess from a fan perspective, the fans knew that they were getting the best, in-ring, bell-to-bell experience that they could. But it's also kind of cool to look over and see Sofia Vergara taking selfies, and that's such a unique experience.
She's A-list star. Yeah.
And or to see whoever else, Adam Jones from Tool, is there,
huge fan.
Every show he'd be coming. And actually Andy Williams, Butcher, he would fly out to shows, or if every time I die would be in LA, he'd be like, oh, I'm gonna stay out an extra day and go to this PWG show.
These shows would also sell out in 3 minutes, right?
Yeah, it was a really hard to get ticket, and that was that was the tough thing of satisfying our fan base that got us to got us up to that point. And then also, because there'd be people that would try to buy out 20 tickets at a time or something like that, and they had never been to a show before. And so we would try to keep the fans that were loyal to us as happy as possible, but still get new fans in. And it became really difficult because that building was so small, and because it was such an exclusive ticket. And you never want to forget the people that got you there.
Sure.
But also, if you keep playing to that same audience, you'll eventually stagnate, and you're not gonna grow. And so it's like, yeah, we have to get new people in there.
How did your business model change as the internet kind of took over the whole DVD? It's funny because I actually bought a documentary on Blu-ray, got it yesterday. I haven't watched something on DVD or Blu-ray in years. I couldn't even figure out how to open the thing. But that's the way we live now. Whereas before, you mentioned DVD sales were one of the cruxes of your financial business.
So that is still our model, is the DVD Blu-ray releases. Yeah. And
people still buy.
People still buy them. And we get hammered every single time we release a show on DVD and Blu-ray to, hey, start streaming. But the thing was, in the... around 2010, there was, TNA was a thing. Ring of Honor was starting up. Everybody was signing everybody to exclusive contracts on the indies.
It
was such a dumb period of time. Mm-hmm. But what would happen then is TNA would pull their guys from our show, or they would say, it's like, you can book them, but you can't put them on the DVD or stuff like that. And you know, so what we did is we were kind of Switzerland, where we didn't sign anybody to contracts. Everybody could come to our place. Everybody could work.
Everybody's welcome.
Yeah, everybody's welcome. And, you know, no bullshit. And so that's why we stuck to DVD when everybody was like signing streaming deals or, you know, licensing out their footage and stuff like that. We were like, no, if we stay neutral, then we can use everybody. And there's no politics and, you know, none of those contractual waters to navigate.
Because there's a lot of people that sign contracts where it's like, okay, you can only work here, but you can still work PWG and New Japan. I know the Young Bucks were signed somewhere, whatever it was.
Well, so the Young Bucks were the ones that were responsible for that because Ring of Honor pulled, I think Adam Cole got hurt on one of our shows, and it was before like a Ring of Honor TV taping. And so Ring of Honor just said, no, they pulled everybody. And then the Bucks said, well, we still want to work PWG. It's, you know, it's right down the road for us. And also it's the place where we got our start, you know, on a big stage. And Ring of Honor's like, I don't know. But then when it came to renegotiate their contracts, they said, well, we want it written in that we can work PWG. Mm. And so they did that, and then it became known as like the Young Bucks deal. And then so when Cole and O'Reilly and Bobby Fish and all those guys, they came to renegotiate, they're like, well, we want the Young Bucks deal. We want to be able to work PWG.
So all it takes is one big name, and suddenly it becomes a thing.
Yeah. And so, and you know, now like we have wrestling is kind of mellowed out in a sense where, I mean, obviously AEW and WWE are in a land grab. But like, I think everybody on the indies realizes like, hey, if we all kind of work together and just cooperate, it's better for everybody. And I think it's the wrestling world is all the better for it, because it only helps. Not only does it help the fans, but it helps the wrestlers too. You know,
is it harder to put on quality shows? First of all, are you still involved with PWG?
Yes. Gotcha. Yeah.
So is it harder to put on quality shows when you mention there is such a just sign as many people as you can?
My involvement is purely on like a production end where, you know, I still do the graphics for the DVDs and the menus and stuff. Super Dragon.
Yeah, you sent me a text this week about a graphic we're working on. Yeah. Like, oh, that's interesting. Excalibur's involved.
That was my day job as I was a graphic designer. And so, I mean, even here at AEW, you know, I'm commentator, but I'm also a marketing manager. And so I'm working two roles. And, you know, like before we got here today, I was like emailing with the Turner people and approving, you know, so it's like everybody around here wears a lot of hats, as you know.
But that's the best thing about wrestling, about anything in show business. The more jobs you can do, the more valuable you are.
Yeah. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of job security for me, which I'm happy about. But yeah, so it's a two-man operation between Super Dragon, who books all the talent, does the creative and all that stuff, and, you know, is scouring the globe for people. And really, I mean, that's what had to happen, is because there's been, you know, WWE with their kind of sign and stash policy, and you know, it's really kind of limited the guys that we're able to book. And so we've had to look a little further afield, whether it's to Mexico or now Australia. And we're bringing a lot of Australian guys over, super talented, but have not been getting the attention that they deserve. And
once again, that's a higher budget.
Yeah, it is. Like, so the travel is expensive. And, you know, I mean, over the years, because, you know, so many costs, you know, renting a building in Philadelphia is so much cheaper than the equivalent size building in LA, especially on a Friday, Saturday night. And so, our costs in that regard are pretty high, but you know, the thing is our fans are loyal. We still, you know, do good business with DVDs and Blu-rays. And then also High Spots has been a great partner with us since day one, and they've really supported us. And so we kind of share some costs with them in terms of, you know.
And that's a DVD company,
High Spots? Yeah, highspots.com. And so they've been really cool with us since day one, very loyal to us. And so, and without them, I don't think we would have made it past, you know, year three or four. Mm-hmm. And so it's cool that we still get to work with them and put out our footage. And then, you know, basically what happens is after a DVD's been out for a year, it goes up on the High Spot streaming service.
Gotcha.
And so that's how we kind of get around these contractual things. And so, yeah, it has been harder to book shows and to get to find new talent. But the thing is, the world is filled with super talented guys. Like I mentioned, when Ring of Honor pulled those guys, and I think it was 2014. Right before that, we had also lost Steen and Generico, and so we were kind of like, oh, we're at a bit of a crossroads. But the 2015 Battle of Los Angeles, it was a blessing in disguise, because that's when Zack Sabre Jr., Will Ospreay, Marty Scurll, and Mark Andrews all made their, and Drew Galloway actually, all made their PWG debut. And so there will always be, you know, somebody that's young and hungry and super talented. And the hard part for us is just finding them.
Right, right. You know? And then keeping them once they get a name.
Well, so I mean, that's the other thing too, is that because we've kept it deliberately small, there's never been any aspirations to be world beaters. And so there came a shift in our promotional mentality. I mean, well, speaking for myself, there came a shift when, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I want to, you know, we should move into a bigger building. We could draw so much more. We could sell this much merch. Where I'm just like, I'm happy guys are getting signed because these are my friends. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, if Steve Regal comes to one of our shows and sees these guys have a killer match, and they get a contract for it, that's literally a life-changing thing that we were able to do for them.
Well, once again, it just gives the reputation of PWG being the place to go if you want to try and break out.
It does, yeah. And I mean, I think the thing that helps is obviously, you know, we have international attention. We have people like Regal coming and stuff like that.
How
and,
is that when a guy like Regal comes? Because he can't, once again, hide out anywhere. Is he out in the crowd?
He hangs out. He comes in the back door, and then what he would literally just...
There's a curtain.
Look through the curtain the entire show. But the thing is, if you were at the bar ordering a drink, you could see around the other side of the curtain. So there's all these pictures of Regal.
Because that's what it is to you. Buy pitchers of beer.
Yep. Yeah.
Sweat your ass off and watch
the my God. Those shows. I mean, because it was, you know, Los Angeles in September, 110 degree day. And then you'd pack 500 people into this building and have wrestling, have lights.
Like ECW Arena.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, that Reseda vibe will never be duplicated. But for a lot of guys, that was, you know, that's like working Corican Hall, you know, for them. Mm-hmm. I remember Desmond Xavier, the first time he wrestled for PWG, it was right after like torrential rain in LA, which, you know, having been to LA, you know, that's not that much. Yeah. But like part of the ceiling had collapsed. The entire building smelled like mold. It was like at its worst possible state. And Des walked in and he's just like, oh my God, this is it. And I'm like, what, this shithole? Like, be careful you don't step on the black mold over there, you know? And, but like, to him, it was something that he'd been watching.
But see, that's what the ECW Arena was too. I think Corican's nicer, but still, like, when I went back to Corican a couple of years ago, I couldn't believe how small it was.
Yeah.
Like, when I worked there in the 90s, it seemed like a giant theater. But you go to these places, these, you know, legendary reputations, and it's just like, gosh, like,
this is it?
I haven't been to the ECW Arena since 96, but if I walked in there now, it would probably be about the size of this room and be like dirty and smelly.
I've been at the arena in the worst of times, and I've been in better times, and they've actually remodeled it.
They've revamped it.
It doesn't have, you know, it doesn't have the same charm as that dump that you wrestled at in 1996. Yeah.
So just a few more things about PWG. What do you see the future of PWG being? Does it have legs to last, to continue on?
I think so. You know, we've definitely slowed down our pace. You know, instead of running once every month, we're about once every 6-8 weeks now. But, you know, I mean, that's part of, you know, growing older and, you know,
wiser,
yeah, and kind of knowing what the audience demands. And I mean, it there was a time when, you know, PWG was like the only super indie on, you know, west of the Mississippi, and then now there's, you know, all these places that are booking guys from around the globe, you know, some of them in LA, there's, you know, Portland and Seattle, you know, Vegas has a thriving scene. And so, you know, it's people don't necessarily need to, fans don't necessarily need to travel as much to see, you know, these amazing wrestlers, and especially like AEW and even NXT, you know, like a large part of the AEW and NXT roster, even the main roster in WWE, came through PWG. Mm-hmm. And so it's like now, you know, unfortunately for PWG, you don't have to travel to Reseda or travel to LA to see these guys. You can just turn on your TV.
Right.
But the people that are lifelong fans and that are passionate about it, they know that, like, this is where you can see the next generation of guys that'll be on TV, and you can see them before they're there. And so that's why I think PWG has legs, and, you know, there is a future there.
Because who's the champion now?
Bandido is the champion.
Okay.
And so he was a guy that we brought in because we lost a large chunk of our roster to NXT, and so we had to start looking for, you know, lucha guys or, you know, different guys. And so Bandido came in, and he was instantly a hit with our fans, and then Ring of Honor took notice of him, and you know, suddenly he's over there. Brody King is another guy that he's an LA guy, but you know, he was really, really hard worker, really great guy, but just never kind of had the opportunities outside of PWG. Mm-hmm. And then once we finally started booking him, he got, you know, noticed on a bigger stage.
What are some of your favorite matches you've ever seen in PWG history?
Oh, there's so many. I think one of my favorite is Chris Hero wrestled Brian Danielson, and this was, I can't remember the year. It was right when he got released for choking Justin Roberts.
2009 or 10.
Yeah. And he came out and he wrestled Hero, who was PWG champion at the time, and they had a phenomenal match. And then after Danielson got on the mic and said, "Hey, he's like, "I'm the new champion, but unfortunately I can't defend this title because I'm going back to WWE."
Oh, wow.
But then he turned it around to total babyface promo. He's like, "But I want the winner of the Battle of Los Angeles to become the new PWG champion." And then Kenny Omega won the Battle of Los Angeles right after. And so there was that. The Young Bucks had so many amazing matches there. But the most memorable, I think, is when they wrestled Joey Ryan and Candice LeRae as world's cutest tag team. And it was in a guerrilla warfare or a hardcore match. And the Bucks actually had an Air Jordan that they glued a bunch of thumbtacks to.
Oh, man.
And they kicked Candice.
Oh, super kick.
And she had Muda level juice. And it was like so unforgettable. Chuck Taylor beat Zack Sabre Jr. He had like a year-long chase of Zack Sabre Jr. in the PWG world title, and he beat him. And it was, I think, the first time I've ever become like really emotional, because like the when he got the three count, the crowd just like they not only popped, but it was like a sigh of relief, because it was like this year-long chase is finally over. And you know, Chuck will admit he's never been the most athletic guy, the most most technically gifted guy, but he was just, you know, he had the support of the crowd. Yeah. And then and so like I had literally like tears in my eyes like when he won, just because of the crowd's reaction, and because, you know, these are my friends and they put on this amazing match. And you know, there's so many emotions that it filled me with. And now I think in my old age, I tend to get a little more sentimental.
That's what wrestling's all about, though. But, well, like I said, a great story about PWG, but then now you're here as Excalibur,
yes,
wearing the mask. Going back to the original question, how was it for you fitting in and where... Still working on it, but 6 months in, finding your place in between. Mm-hmm. What role is Jim? What role is Tony? What role is Excalibur? Tell us about your first few times and how you were able to figure that out.
You know, there was you know, a very steep learning curve. And, you know, like, I mean, you mentioned you didn't get it, why I wore the mask. Jim didn't get it. There was a lot of people that didn't get it. But I think once, you know, once people heard my work, and I mean, hopefully this is your feelings, that, you know, I kind of won you over, and like, or at least you learned to trust me and my, you know, my instincts, and you realize I'm not, you know, I'm not a self-serving announcer. I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to get.
Yeah, see, I never thought of it. It's funny too, because we see you guys on camera, you know, once
30 seconds a show maybe, yeah.
And you could be wearing full on, you know, Gene Simmons Kiss makeup. What does it matter when all we hear,
right,
your representation on the show is your voice and your analysis of what's going on. Mm-hmm. So I think to me the mask was just something that didn't make sense, but then it's wrestling, dude.
Yeah.
And we have an announcer that has a mask, and if you do a good job, it's not going to matter. And I'm sure it was the same with Jim. I bet you Vince, when he first came in, didn't want to wear a cowboy hat.
Yep.
Have you ever had that conversation?
No, I haven't. Okay. But that is a conversation.
It was there. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it was a steep learning curve. I was nervous as hell at Double or Nothing, you know, going in, because I'm calling basically 5 straight hours with Jim Ross and Alex Marvez. And then we get to Dynamite on October 2nd. And now I'm calling it on national TV in front of an even larger audience. And luckily by that point, I wasn't as nervous, but I still had butterflies. And now... It's not that I don't get nervous. It's just that this has become my job.
And
I've become more accustomed to it. But I'm still super concerned with my preparation, with my notes. I have my routine on Wednesday morning when I'm typing up my notes. I mean, I did notes for this. Mm-hmm.
I just realized. Yeah, yeah.
But you know, I mean, that's me. I want to prep and I want to do the best job possible. And I think, you know, the reception I've gotten from you know, the AEW people, the Turner people, and most importantly, the fans, has been that I'm doing a good job. And I just, as long as I can continue to, you know, maintain and raise that standard of quality, I'm happy. And, you know, I'm so thrilled to be part
of this. How about from your peers, what advice has Jim or Tony given you?
Jim's advice is always, less is more, kid. We don't get paid by the word. And, but it's great because, being more concise, you know, I mean, when I'm doing PWG commentary, I'm literally doing it by myself, talking into a headset that feeds directly into the hard cam.
You're Joey Styles, your play by play and
color and all of it. Yes.
Analysis and everything. Yeah.
And so I had to learn when to lay out, how to lay out, how to pitch to, you know, Tony or pitch to Jim. And, you know, last week, there was one segment where Jim's usually the one that takes us to break. But there was one segment where I was in the middle of the sentence and we got the countdown in our ear. And he's like, oh, 5 seconds to break. Usually we get 10, but for whatever reason, I only got 5. And so because I was in the middle sentence, I pitched to break, but I pitched too soon. And so there's like 3 seconds of dead air. And afterwards, I went to Jim and I was like, man, you make that look a lot easier than it is. Yeah. Because he's been doing this for so long. He's got a 3 second version. He's got a 5 second, an 8 second, a 10 second. You know, like he knows. Just
instinct knows how long it is, right?
And, you know, and then Shivani is the master of like the live reads and doing that stuff and working in website promos or ticket promos and stuff like that. And I, you know, I think the wrestling stuff I have a decent grasp on. I'm always asking Jim or Tony or Taz, you know, like for advice or listening to how they do things to try to improve my game. But it's stuff like the broadcast stuff. That's where, you know, I think I have the biggest room for improvement. And so just working alongside literally Tony Schiavone and Jim Ross, like that is a dream job that I never even dreamt existed. And so getting to learn from them on a weekly basis is amazing.
You mentioned Taz and I forgot you also do Dark. What are the differences for you doing Dynamite in comparison to doing Dark?
Dark is a lot looser because we don't have to, you know, pitch to break. We don't have to worry about commercial or anything like that. We can just call a match straight through. We don't have to worry about, you know, doing ticket on sales or mentioning the TNT movie of the week or things like that. So it's just, you know, it's just straight wrestling. But it's also Taz and I, you know, I'm, you know, when I'm there with Jim and Tony, I do, you know, I mostly do analysis and play by play. But when I'm there with Taz, obviously, you know, like I'm nobody in, you know, in the wrestling world, but compared to Taz, I'm especially nobody.
But you're also doing more play by play on Dark as Taz is more of the color commentator.
Yeah. Correct? And so, yeah. And so we kind of,
you know, is good for you to wear that hat as well.
Yeah. And so it's a good
experience. That mask.
Yeah. It's the same mask.
Right.
But it is a good experience because it gives me, you know, a different role to play, but also with somebody that has tons of broadcast experience. And that's, if nothing else, that's been the biggest gift is like these guys that have, you know, probably if you put it all together, they probably have 100 years of combined broadcast experience and getting to, you know, I got to work with Dave freaking Brown.
Right.
Like how awesome Memphis. Is that? Yeah. And so it's like, these guys have been calling wrestling forever and just seeing how they react to stuff or their timing or, you know, when they lay out, how they lay out, you know, like that sort of stuff is so, so important. And so, yeah, I mean, I love doing Dynamite, but, that's more of like, that's more of business. Dark is when like you can kind of loosen the tie and cut loose.
But like you said, all that stuff's important because you're expected to be a pro. Like we said, you got thrown the deep end from doing DVDs to live television with, you know, Jim Ross, legendary Hall of Famer, and Tony as well. But you're here for a reason. So it's cool to kind of, you know, put on your fanboy hat for 5 seconds and then realize I got to be great at this or I'm not going to be here. And there's been commentators and backstage announcers that were here in October that aren't here now. Not mentioning names, it doesn't matter. But point is, was there ever a point in time, like did you ever think to yourself, I'm in way over my head, or were you thinking, okay, I can do this, but I've got to really do better?
Yes. That's exactly what I thought is that, you know, I mean, like we, as performers, we all have ego and, you know, it's like, so, I mean, I knew I was good. I knew, you know, what I brought to the table, but I knew I had to improve in order to be on a national television broadcast. And so that's why, you know, I mean, whether it was my day job in graphic design or, you know, wrestling commentary, I take these things equally as seriously, and I prepare and I put a lot
as a pro.
Yeah, I put that much effort into it. And so, yes, I mean, it's the type of thing where, you know, I will hopefully never stop improving. And the day I stop improving or the day I become complacent is the day that, you know, I quite frankly might deserve to lose my job.
Right. But I mean, that, and that's the thing. Like, I remember the first time I ever walked into a WCW locker room, Manatee Civic Center, Palmetto, Florida, Nitro. It wasn't the first time because I'd done a couple of minor shows, but first time on Nitro. And I walked into a dressing room, you know, talent, whatever the hell it said, and there's Lex Luger and Sting and Flair and Arn. And I just walked in there, and it's like, for 2 seconds, as everyone stops to look at me, I almost feel like I'm a fan that went too far. And I'm backstage. And then I'm like, okay, have 2 seconds of freak out. And then it's like, hey guys, Chris Jericho, nice to meet you. And then sit down and go about my business. And it's a really weird feeling, but that's how you have to treat it when you're there.
Imposter syndrome.
That's right. Yeah.
But, and I mean, I did have an element of that. I mean, with you especially, like I mentioned what a big fan of the junior heavyweight, you know, wrestling style was. And so, you know, to be sitting across the room from the guy that was in the Super J Cup for me is a huge thing.
Right.
And, you know, when I first met Luther, I was like, holy shit, that's Dr. Luther, you know, and it's like, and a lot of people didn't know who he was. And like, Moxley was like, wait, who's that guy? I'm like, dude, that's fucking Dr. Luther from FMW. He's like, no way. And then and so like, yes, there are those fanboy moments. And, you know, like when I got to call a couple of Ligers matches, and that was so huge for me. And so it's like, I think the biggest thing I try to do is not take it for granted. You know, it's like, yes, this is my job. This is where I come every week, but I've been a lifelong wrestling fan. And so to be able to have the opportunity to do this is an incredible gift. So I never hope and I never want to take this for granted. I always want to, you know, I mean, there'll come a day when you're no longer wrestling, you know, Liger just retired. And so like these guys that I grew up with are, you know, going away, but then there will be the MJFs, the Jungle Boys, the Marco
Stunts.
That's
the circle of life, right?
And, you know, then I get to kind of reverse roles where it's like I'm the respected, quote, hopefully respected, but you know what I mean? I'm the elder statesman, and I get to impart advice to them. And I've even found a lot of guys coming up to me, you know, like, cause I'm just a dude, you know?
No, but I just understand your point. I appreciate your humbleness, but you're also the conduit for, like, I come and talk to you guys almost every week. This is what I would like to get across. Say it in your own words, of course, but this, and this have to be addressed. Mm. And if guys don't come to you, you might miss those things. So it's the nuances. I remember once again, Joey Styles used to come every week. What do you got? What can I do? What can I do to help? And, you know, it's very important. Vince would have a meeting with Lawler and JR every week. This is what I want you guys to get across. So you are just the dude, but you're also the dude that is the mouthpiece for these nuances that have to be told.
Yeah, you're right. And I mean, I think that's been the toughest thing to wrap my head around where, you know, like, again, with PWG, it, you know, we had a much smaller audience, obviously, than Dynamite does. But, you know, I knew everybody that I saw at the building that day, like, you know, in terms of like the staff and the wrestlers and stuff like that. But here, I mean, this is such a monumental production where, you know, I just feel like sometimes like a cog in the machine. But I do have to pinch myself and remind myself that, you know, I am the soundtrack to
this
right.
show. You're the voice. Yeah. As we wind down here, what have you seen improve over the last five, I'll say 6 months, it might not have been exactly 6 months, but on the weekly Dynamite and show, because you and Jim are the two guys that have, well, you especially, including Dark, have watched every single match from beginning to now.
The only match that I have not commentated is the one you kicked me out of.
Right.
It was Luchasaurus and was it Sammy, I think?
Yeah.
but yeah, I think the two things that I've seen in is that the guys that have never wrestled on TV or never wrestled in, you know, big arenas, they've gotten their sea legs.
Yeah.
You know, and that's always gonna happen. But, you know, unfortunately they're under the microscope. And so, you know, to see Jungle Boy, who, I mean, you know, he's the most nervous guy I've ever seen before, you know, a match or anything like that, but he's gotten shockingly less nervous as time goes on. Like, I mean, he used to be
again, just like you, you know, that's the way it works.
Yeah. And, you know, to see him, you know, calm down and, you know, just kind of come to grips with the situation, to see, you know, Marco go out there and, you know, feel that he can be comfortable. And, he, you know, so that's been an improvement. So seeing these young guys, or, you know, not necessarily young guys, but guys that have never performed in front of this size of audience, being able to have that composure and, you know, keep things crisp, you know, keep the action flowing. And then I think the other thing too is just, you know, from a business side, is tightening up the production, you know, like the script and the run of show and things like that. You know, I mean, there was a lot of, I mean, there's always going to be experimentation in wrestling. Nobody knows 100% what the audience wants. But I think the way we experiment has improved. And so, you know, we realized certain angles weren't working, and so we just, you know, we cut bait on them. And when that happens on a TV show, it's kind of irksome, but it's like, you know, it's like, why did they do that? But, you know, I mean, this is a weekly television thing. It's, you know, a TV show is only, you know, 16 episodes, you know, where this is 52 a year, right, times every year. How many years? Yeah. And so there has to be, you know, times when, you know,
not everything's going to work.
Yeah.
Right.
And, but, you know, just the internal logic of the creative here has improved. And I think everybody realizes, you know, like, okay, this might have worked in a different audience. This might have worked on the indies. This might have worked in Japan. This might have worked somewhere else. It's not necessarily going to work, not even in front of our live audience, but our televised audience. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference in how things are received, you know, on your living room couch versus being in the arena.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, we had a group of people, myself included. I have a much bigger role in the shaping and creative of Dynamite than I ever did in WWE, mm-hmm. and not just for my own stuff, but everything, production elements and, you know, music and light switches and vignettes and all that sort of stuff. But we had a whole group of people that are basically starting this from scratch. Mm-hmm. How do you do that? Some things are going to be perfect. Other things are going to need stuff to work. You know, you have to shape and work in it better. But I've really seen a difference of a whole crew that have never really experienced live TV, yourself included. Mm-hmm. Very few of us, Jim Ross, Cody, Jericho, Dustin, Moxley, dealt with it, mm-hmm. Hager, but most of us haven't. So to see that come together so quickly has been really cool to experience and be a part of it.
Yeah, it's, I mean, before Double or Nothing, you know, I did some New Japan shows with Kevin Kelly, and that was a great experience because Kevin is also like a you know, very experienced broadcaster, but over there, he's producing himself. Mm-hmm. You know, he's the only guy on his team, yeah, that speaks English. And so he's, you know, he's doing it all. And so, like, you know, going from that to this environment where we have an entire truck of people, but, you know, that are producing and doing all this stuff and watching as the weeks go by. And, you know, because not everybody here is, you know, I mean, you said not everybody has TV experience, but not even our production crew, not everybody has wrestling experience. Right. There's a lot of guys that came from Turner or college sports or wherever they might have been. So that it's, you know, shooting wrestling is a different animal, mm-hmm. or producing wrestling and the timing and the camera positioning and all these things. And so seeing these guys learn and adapt very quickly, and sometimes, you know, like a 1 week basis, things will turn around and change. That's been really cool. And I think as time goes on, we're only going to get better.
Yeah. Last two questions. How did you design your mask?
I took great Sasuke's mask and I ripped it off, and I just put some flourishes on it. The little crest on my forehead I ripped off from Black Bolt from the Eternals and Marvel Comics.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and that's great. Sasuke was my guy, and so like I wanted to do something to kind of an homage to him.
Did you see him this year at the Dome?
I did. That was super awesome. And yeah, and so that's what it was. Like, I mean, everything was part and parcel. Is just all goes back to Michinoku Pro.
Oh yeah, Super Delphin.
Yeah.
What's your favorite match that you've commentated here in AEW, or a few of them?
Cody and Dustin, yeah. Because it was just so emotional, and you know, it's so special. The ladder match with the Bucks and the Lucha Bros. Right.
That was great.
And for very personal reasons, your match with Scorpio Sky.
Oh, wow.
Because I've known Sky for 16, 17 years, yeah. 17 and a half years. And so to see that kid I knew, you know, that trained at the Rev Pro Dojo, you know, way back in 2003, wrestling Chris Jericho, mm-hmm. on national TV was so freaking awesome. And like, it was like, it makes me smile. I mean, you can see I'm smiling now because I'm talking, I'm just remembering it. And so it's like, that's the type of rewarding stuff that, you know, is so special to me about this, is seeing guys grow and seeing guys be able to live out their dream.
And your friends too.
Yeah.
Do you know what lexicon means now?
I do. It's a list of words. It's not a list of names.
Thanks, dude. Get to
Thank
work.
Thank you, man.